Hello, I'm Matthew. I'm the lead pastor here at Cedar Ridge, and I want to welcome you again to our service this morning. Thank you so much for joining us. We're in a series at the moment called Uncomfortable Conversations with Jesus, and the story we just read is, I think, by any standards, an uncomfortable one. We've actually called the message today, Follow Me into Self-Denial, Suffering and Death, and other warm invitations from Jesus. Slightly ironic title, but I think it captures the fact that here's Jesus talking about his own death and inviting us into to follow him into a similar pathway. So that's very uncomfortable. And then the encounter itself between Peter and Jesus is uncomfortable. It starts off kind of friendly, agreeable, but then it quickly turns and becomes almost hostile. Jesus seems very intense, almost hostile towards Peter. In his response to him and his challenge to him. So we're just going to unpack this story a little bit. We'll look for three things, really. We're going to just try to probe the meaning a little, look at some of the background, try to understand it better. Then we'll try to look at what is Jesus teaching here? What is Jesus saying? And how is that uncomfortable? And what can we learn from that? And then thirdly, we'll look at the ways that Peter and Jesus interact and look for some learnings for us about learnings that we can take into our own uncomfortable conversations, ones that we're having already or maybe ones that we need to have. So let's jump into the story a little bit. We're told very specifically at the beginning that this story is set in Caesarea Philippi, and that's significant. Caesarea Philippi is 25 to 30 miles northwest of the Sea of Galilee. So it's not all that far from Jesus' stomping ground, his sort of home area. But it's across the River Jordan and in a Roman-ruled area, in a Roman town. This is a very Roman town. The name kind of gives that away, Caesarea Philippi. It was named after two people. Firstly, Augustus Caesar, and there was a big temple built in his honor there. And then secondly, after Philip II, who was one of the Herods. And the Herods were the kings that the Romans put in place to rule over the Jewish people. They were actually not purely Jewish themselves. They were from a mixed background. But they were the kings of the Jews, if you like, who were given different territories and jurisdiction over different territories. And this Caesarea Philippi is in Philip II's jurisdiction. And that's what the Romans did. They would appoint local puppet leaders who had to control the population, keep things in order. And if they failed to do that, there were terrible consequences. So we have here a center of Roman power and kind of center of Jewish, if not religious, compromise with that power. There are also other power dynamics going on here. In Caesarea Philippi, Mount Hermon is not far away, and that was the sort of mythological birthplace of the Greek deity Pan, and the Romans really adopted the Greek gods, so that was a very significant god to the Romans. Pan was a half goat, half human, was believed to preside over forests and woodlands, and was associated with fertility and sexuality. So a lot of people worship Pan in order to have fertile lives in every sense, and that probably meant as much success in business, success in agriculture, as much as it had anything to do with human fertility. But Pan is it's interesting because in Caesarea Philippi there was a big cave. There still is a big cave called the Cave of Pan. And in Jesus's time, it's likely that the River Jordan actually flowed out of that cave. It might have been the springs of the River Jordan. It seems like since then there's been some earthquakes and that kind of thing, and it's the Jordan no longer flows out of there. But that itself was very significant. And it was also believed to be the gateway to Hades, the underworld. And we heard that referred to in the story, the gates of Hades will not prevail. And so it had this very mythological, mystical association. You can actually see the Cave of Pan today if you go back to Caesarea Philippi. But the association with Pan, the association with the gateway to Hades, meant it drew a lot of pilgrims, a lot of pagan worshippers who found that this location gave them access to the gods. They were able to have visions and dreams. So it was a very significant place. And it's in this place of religious power, of pagan power, of political power, that Jesus asks this question: who do you say that I am? He starts off, of course, by saying, who do people say that I am? And the disciples respond, generally, well, some say you're John the Baptist come back from the dead. And that, it's interesting, the connotation there, because Philip II's half-brother, Herod Antipas, had beheaded John. So the Herods would not want John the Baptist to come back from the dead. So I think they were probably afraid of Jesus. Some were saying, oh, it's John the Baptist back from the dead. Some it's Jeremiah, some it's Elijah, one of the prophets. And then Jesus kind of homes in and says, well, what about you? Who do you think I am? And Peter speaks up, and he speaks with conviction and courage. Who knows? He might be going out on a limb, but he says, you're the Christ, the Messiah, which is what Christ means, the Son of the living God. He kind of nails it and just comes out and says this. And Jesus' response to him is really positive. It's a beautiful response. It's a blessing. We'll actually look at that in verse 17 to 19. It says, Jesus replied, blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for this was not revealed to you by flesh and blood, but by my Father in heaven. I tell you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overcome it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. So Jesus here is, that's just a wonderful statement to Peter. He calls Peter in the Greek Petros, which means rock, and changes his name from Simon to Peter. So from then on, Simon is known as Peter, and that's how we refer to him today. That word, it's a pun, because Petros it means rock, or it's actually Petra. It's the female in Greek that means rock. But Jesus uses that same root word to rename Peter. And the connotation is, you're going to be the rock on which I build my following. So incidentally, Peter was in Aramaic. Jesus would have been speaking Aramaic to Peter. That was their language, vernacular. And in Aramaic, the word for rock or stone is kephas. And a lot of places in the Christian scriptures, Peter is referred to as kephas. Paul calls him kephas all the time, for instance. But there's the pun there with calling Peter a rock. And the insinuation there is that Peter has had this divine revelation. This is higher consciousness. This didn't just come from it's a human source or from some low consciousness. This is revelation. And not only that, it's that revelation that Jesus is the Messiah, Jesus is the Christ. That's the basis on which his whole following, the church, literally translated, that word there is the ecclesia. It's the word for gathering. So it's kind of like Jesus's following is based on this truth that Jesus is the Christ, Jesus is the Messiah. So very important, very crucial, Peter has kind of gone out on a limb perhaps and said what he really in his guts believes, and Jesus affirms him and says some pretty amazing things. There's lots of heaven to earth kind of language. I'm going to give you the keys to the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. There's this sense of the messiahship of Jesus being about a whole other way of life. It's not, Jesus talks about the kingdom of heaven in Matthew. That's how the kingdom of God is referred to. This way of the kingdom is otherworldly. It's not just the way of the world. It comes from somewhere above, somewhere much higher. And I don't think we're necessarily meant to think of heaven and earth in that sense as two locations so much as two dimensions, two ways. There's the way of the world and there's the way of heaven. And Jesus is saying that his way of heaven is going to be founded on this principle that he's the Christ, he's the Messiah. So, really important, really beautiful. We get the Pan or Cave of Pan analogy there where he says the gates of Hades will not prevail. In other words, this life of the kingdom that I'm bringing, this real life, death can't prevail over it. Some great imagery, some great graphic language. So at this point, not really all that uncomfortable. Maybe Peter felt a little uncomfortable going out on a limb and saying, declaring his convictions. But other than that, not really all that uncomfortable. However, there's a little twist right at the end of that first part where Jesus says, don't tell anybody about this. And you're kind of left wondering, why is this? Why not? I mean, if that's true, then why not tell everybody? I think Jesus probably means people aren't ready for the implications of this yet. We kind of find that out now in the second half of the story. Doesn't seem like it happens immediately after the first part, because it says from that time on, Jesus began to talk about his death. So, this may have been still in Caesarea Philippi. We're not sure, but it certainly goes on beyond their time in Caesarea Philippi. But we're told this part of the story back to back with the first part, and it's very, very different. There's a clash, a major uncomfortable clash of perspectives. It's as though in the first section, we're told that Jesus is the Messiah. So there's a definition of who is the Messiah. In this second story, there's a definition of what messiahship means. And it's not what people were expecting, certainly not what Peter was expecting. I would dare to suggest, in our heart of hearts, not what we're expecting or necessarily really want the Messiah to be. We've just got so used to this story and so used to language about Jesus and what Jesus is about that that sense of surprise is a little lost on us. But this clash of perspectives is stark. It's almost hostile. It feels confrontational. It feels very uncomfortable. Jesus is basically saying that the Messiah is going to be treated violently, is going to suffer, and is going to die. And Peter totally disagrees with that. That is not Peter's definition of messiahship. And so he pushes back on Jesus. It says he actually takes him aside and rebukes him. And Jesus comes back with some really strong language, as we heard. In verse 23, Jesus says, Jesus turned and said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me. You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns." So here we have almost like an echo, or a negative image of the previous statement where Jesus was saying, "Oh, you've heard this from my Father in heaven. This is there was all the heaven coming to earth kind of language." Here Jesus is saying, "Hey, get behind me, Satan." And you have your mind on earthly things. Now this isn't higher revelation. This isn't higher consciousness. This is your thinking in the way of the world, and it's the wrong way. You don't get it. And again, it's kind of Jesus lets him know this in no uncertain terms. So what's going on here? What's really the issue here? I think what we've got to bear in mind is that we're looking at this story through the lens of having read the whole story, and we know the beginning, we know the end, through the lens of 2,000 years of church history. It's not very surprising to us. But for the disciples, for the followers of Jesus at that time, and certainly for Peter, the thought that the Messiah was going to suffer and die was outrageous. It was crazy. And the key to this, I think, is where Jesus talks about taking up our crosses in verse 24 through to verse 26. Let's just read that section and then we'll sort of comment on it. It says, "Then Jesus said to his disciples, 'Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me will find it. What good will it be for someone to gain the whole world yet forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul?'" Now, I think we've got to think about this. We've talked about this before, that when we hear the word cross, we think of Jesus' crucifixion. And cross has all sorts of connotations for us. It has connotations of forgiveness. It has connotations of resurrection, because we know what happened after that. It certainly has connotations of suffering, for sure. But at the time that Jesus said this, so when he's talking to his disciples, the crucifixion has not happened yet. The resurrection has not happened yet. And so there was only one context, really, for them to understand what does the cross mean. The cross was how Romans executed people. That's what they crucified, people who were non-Roman citizens, so slaves or non-citizens, rebels, and citizens that were committing treason. So in other words, if you if you were being crucified, and you would know somebody was going to be crucified because they were made to carry their cross or part of the cross, the crossbar, the patibulum. They were meant to carry. They were forced to carry that through the streets as an act of shame as they walked themselves to their own crucifixion. So if you saw somebody carrying their cross, it meant they had committed either treason against Rome or rebelled against Rome. And it was an act of power on the part of Rome to execute people like that. So that's the context that these followers of Jesus have for that. And at the same time, remember that when Jesus is talking about the kingdom of God, in Matthew's gospel, he refers to the kingdom of heaven. But when he's talking about the kingdom of heaven, let's think about kingdoms and kings. What was the context for that? Well, it's, remember, they're in Caesarea Philippi. It's Caesar and Herod and those kind of kings of territories in the world. And they exercised their authority through power. And often violence, maintaining power through violence. So when Jesus is talking about the kingdom of God, and that there's this new way, there's this greater way, I think it would have been quite normal for the association to be, well, that must mean overpowering the current kingdoms. If Jesus's way is the real way, then, and Jesus is king, then Jesus, it must mean Jesus is going to take over from Herod, take over from Caesar, he'll overcome them. And you imagine that Peter, part of why Peter is so perplexed and taking Jesus aside and saying, this isn't going to happen, that can't happen, is because Peter is convinced that the Messiah is going to defeat Rome, the Messiah is going to usher in this political kingdom that's going to set everybody free. It's going to be wonderful. It's going to be loving, etc., etc. But the only way of doing that is through power. You've just got to outdo the Romans at being the Romans, if you like. You've got to outdo Herod at being Herod. You have to have more power than those guys to take over. So I think, again, we have the benefit of hindsight. We've had 2,000 years of church history where we've wrestled with the words of Jesus. At that moment in time, I doubt, certainly for me, I don't think I would have thought any different than Peter. And Peter's obviously kind of, he tends to speak his mind. We may have, depending on our personality, we may have been a bit more quiet, a bit more subtle about it. But I think in our heart of hearts, we'd be like, that's crazy. Why are you going to let yourself die? Why are you going to let these people bully you? Why are you going to let power defeat you? Why won't you fight and stand up for yourself and gather this ecclesia, the church, which is perhaps being viewed in Peter's eyes as more like, yeah, you're going to have a gathering and it's going to be like your army. We're going to take over. We'll overcome. Why would you not leverage that? Why are you letting go of this? And not only that, so that's uncomfortable itself, having declared you are the Messiah, to then find out that Jesus has a very different idea of what the Messiahship means. But then to hear Jesus say, and actually, I said I was going to build my church on this rock. Well, my church is also going to follow me in this same kind of lifestyle of suffering and death. What on earth does Jesus mean and why? And I think what we have here really is the essence, in my view, it's the essence of the gospel. It's the fact that when it comes to messiahship, when it comes to the heart of Christianity, when it comes to what is divine action in our world, it's not power, it's not force, it's vulnerable love. And the way of the kingdom, the way of Jesus, the way of the Messiah, the way of God is not the way of the world, which is all about power all about force. It's about letting go and love, and letting love win people over, letting love win the day. And again, that's kind of language that I think we're familiar with. But if we think about it in these terms, that meant that the Messiah, if the Messiah was not going to resort to power, if the Messiah was not going to outdo the Romans with the Roman way and not outdo Herod with the Herod way, then it was inevitable that Jesus would be opposed and inevitable, really. And I think this is what Jesus is getting at, that Jesus was going to be killed. And that then begs the question, what do you do then? Do you then give up this ideal of love, of sacrificial, vulnerable love, and fight? Or do you love even to the point of death? And Jesus is saying, my way means loving even to the point of death, and loving to the point where you may look a complete failure. You're loving to the point where it may look like you've lost everything, but never giving up on love. And I think this is what's so incredible about the cross. The cross is that symbol, that identification of love triumphing over fear, of love triumphing over power. It's as though the divine message, the divine call to humanity is not, you better follow me or else. It's not, I can't really stand you. Somebody has to be punished for how bad you are. And so that's going to be Jesus. I think what the cross is saying is, I love you no matter what. There's nothing that can separate you from me. No matter how much I'm hated, no matter how much violence is thrown against me, I will never stop loving. I am willing to suffer whatever consequences rather than give up on loving you. It's like God saying, let's be done with hatred and fear. Let's come to me and I'll show you how to love. You will be loved and I'll show you how to love. I often think in these situations as a little bit like, you know, an analogy I draw for, and this is helpful to me, but I think with my kids, I have four kids, they're all grown up now, but I think my kids, especially when they were younger, I just wanted them to love me. I loved them so much and wanted them to love me. I didn't want to force them to love me. That had been just so fake and cheap. I didn't want to pretend to love me or to love me because they were afraid of me. I just wanted them to love me because I love them so much. It's a reciprocal thing. And I think often with God, we paint God as this character that's sort of forcing us to return love. You know, it's like on threat of punishment, or you know, God's way is power. God's way is, you know, and let's face it, God is powerful. And I think, again, coming back to sort of Peter's conundrum, it's like, why on earth would somebody with all that power not want to wield that power to get what you want or to get the good things done? But I think we know that power ultimately, it results in violence, it results in control, it results in fear. It's not ultimately solving the problems problems of humanity. Only love can do that. So, you know, I think this is an intense encounter because the stakes are so high. Jesus is saying, look, my way is a whole different way. It doesn't look anything like you think it looks. It doesn't look perhaps even anything like what you want it to look like. But follow me, stay with me, take up your cross with me, rebel against the way of the world with me. And I'll show you a different way, a way that ultimately is going to win people over. But it's going to be, it's not going to be quick. It's going to be this long journey of love that we need to embark on. So I think an implication for us there is that whether we are Caesar, Herod, you know, people who have a lot of power, or whether we're people like Jesus and Peter, who in this story don't have a lot of power compared to Herod and Caesar anyway, or just people like us, we all have to deal with this issue of, are we going to choose the way of love, of sacrificial love, and let go of our lives and just keep on loving, even though it's going to inevitably mean suffering, because we will be opposed and people will abuse us. People will take advantage of us. And if we don't fight back and demand our own right, you know, our own share of the spoils, if you like, we're going to be taken for a ride. Do we choose that way, or do we choose fear and fear that leads to power, fear that leads to power and control, where we don't want to lose things. We want to be in charge and in control and have our way. I think that's a huge issue for all of us right here. And, you know, I think we can, when we think of it in terms of political power, religious power, or celebrity power, or, you know, there are powerful people in the world, right? I mean, we know that, and we probably don't feel that powerful. It's pretty obvious that with people who have a lot of power, it's obvious when fear is triumphing over love, when fear is being chosen over love. I think we see that played out in politics all the time. We see it in world history. We see it in the history of humanity. People with power will do things to conserve their power, to conserve their wealth, to conserve their privilege. They're not thinking about giving that up. They're not thinking about suffering and sacrifice. It's pretty obvious, and we see that embodied in Herod and in Caesar. But what about us? Because I know that every day I have choices to make. I have a choice to make about turning the other cheek in a confrontational situation, a choice to forgive somebody or to ask for forgiveness. I have a choice to make about sharing my things or conserving my things and being like, I'm not going to give anything away. I'm not going to share anything because I might be left without. I have a choice to make about being the first to initiate love, you know, whatever our relationship, whether it's a friendship, a marriage, whatever. You know, do we wait for other people to initiate because that's safer and we can just respond? Or are we prepared to go out on a limb and to initiate love towards somebody else? That can make us feel vulnerable. So so many ways, a personal relational level where we face these choices every day. And do we want to wield our power in a situation which might be limited, but you know, the power of withdrawal and putting some distance between us and another person? Or do we choose the way of love, of sacrificial love? We encounter that at work. Are we willing to let other people get credit for work that we've done or contributed to? Are we climbing the ladder and climbing on people, over people to get up the ladder? All those kind of choices that play out in everyday life. I think it also happens at a more collective level personally. That sounds a little bit of a contradiction, but what I mean by that is, are we willing, you know, we're talking a lot at the moment about racial injustice in our culture. Are we willing to open ourselves up to the possibility that we might be participating in an unjust system? Those are hard truths and hard realities to address and to reflect on and have conversations on. It's easier, I think, when we're afraid that we might be found guilty or we're afraid of what the truth might be, to pull back and not choose love, but choose power and control and maintaining the status quo. In our culture, are we willing to face some of the harder issues? So the term, for instance, white supremacy sounds such an ugly term. We might feel offended at that term because we don't feel like we're a white supremacist. But are we willing to open ourselves up to the reality that some people see this culture as white supremacism? Are we willing to open ourselves up to the reality that we might be complicit in that system? It's uncomfortable and it can put fear in our heart. But the way of love is a choice to follow Jesus the Messiah into those kinds of sacrificial, vulnerable places. So I think this is really, really important for us. This teaching of Jesus is really, really important for us and one that I think we have to wrestle with. We see in the rest of the Gospel of Matthew, the disciples wrestling with that and coming to terms with it. And I think it was difficult. And I don't think they came to terms with it really until Jesus came back from the dead. They didn't come to terms with it until Jesus was gone and they were having to work all this out for themselves. I think one interesting thing when we look at going back to when we think about how this Jesus's words were first heard. Jesus mentions in the passage we just read that I will come back to life on the third day. Now that we might think, well, you know, Jesus isn't just talking about the suffering, you know, he's talking about coming back to life. So, you know, why didn't they get that? Why didn't they understand that? I think, I wonder how clear it was communicated, how clearly it was taught by Jesus to his disciples about the resurrection, because really they, their You know, when we have the Gospels written, they're written by people who knew the end of the story as well, right? So you know, of course, when Jesus talks about his death, he talks about his resurrection as well. But for these disciples, I, if you think about it, if Jesus had taught that really clearly, and as we read that passage even, when Jesus says, okay, I'm going to die, but after 3 days, I'm going to come back to life. The really remarkable thing about that, the real standout is you're going to come back to life after you're dead. I mean, people die and people get opposed in the time of the Romans and even today and die. So Jesus dying in one sense is not, it's not good news, but it's not very unusual. But coming back to life after 3 days is, that's very unusual. So why weren't the disciples more tuned into that? Why, you know, for instance, after Jesus dies, if Jesus had taught so clearly that he's going to come back to life after 3 days, why isn't anybody saying, wait a second, Jesus said this would happen. Let's at least give it 3 days and see if he was right about coming back to life as well. We don't hear any of that kind of talk. Now, it could be that they just forgot it all. But if somebody's talking about coming back from the dead that clearly, I'm not sure you're going to forget about that. I think this whole thing about Jesus dying, whether he was going to come back to life again or not, that's what dominated their thinking. And they, when he did die, I think they were clearly desperately disappointed and felt like that's the end of it. That's the end of it, because they still hadn't grasped what Jesus was saying. And it's so easy for us, I think, reading it in hindsight. It was relatively easier for the gospel writers because they had the end of the story in mind when they're writing it. But for Jesus' followers, this was really intense. And I think it could help us to perhaps identify more with their apparent ignorance about the way of Jesus and what it really is. And by recognizing that, we may think we get it, but maybe we don't. Maybe we're not as tuned in as we'd like to think we are. And in our day-to-day lives, we are much more thinking life is about power and control. Life is about success. It's about getting ahead. It's about preserving our own lives. It's not about giving our lives away. It's not about losing. It's not about sacrificial love. I mean, it's about loving, being loving, of course, but it's love that leads to success, love that wins people over and you know, everybody's happy in the end. That's not the kind of love that Jesus is talking about. He's talking about love that goes to the point of death and beyond. And, you know, most of us are not going to be asked to do that. But when I'm in an argument with somebody, when I'm in an uncomfortable conversation, I have some choices I can make about choosing power and control, fear, or choosing love, and risking vulnerability, and risking not looking like I won the argument, or not looking like I was right, or not looking that I had my act together. These are the small sort of micro opportunities we have to live this out day in, day out. That's what following Jesus means. And I think that's what Jesus is calling us to. That's what Jesus is saying when he says, on this rock, on this revelation of that, I am the Messiah, I'm going to build my church. My followers will live like this. They will think like this, act like this, believe like this, be like this. You know, the question is that really what we want to be? Are we going to follow Jesus in that kind of way? So let's just think about some of the challenges from this this particular story. You know, there's some challenges from the teaching itself. So you know, let's just think about three of them. You know, are we willing to choose love over fear? Think about that in every situation that we're in our lives. And there's we have discussion materials accompanying the series, and this week's discussion materials also have a prayer exercise that kind of helps us focus in on that on a daily basis, choosing love over fear and being more aware about that in our own lives, our own circumstances, you know, not in some theoretical sense, but in how we actually live and make choices each day. Where are we a stumbling block? You know, Jesus is calling Peter a stumbling block. You know, where are we not aware of the fact that we're practicing fear rather than love? You know, that's something for us to think about. That's a challenge for us. I don't think Peter thought he was a stumbling block. I think he thought he was helping out by saying, no, Jesus, that's not going to happen to you. And then thirdly, you know, maybe we can begin to see our lives in a different light. What I mean by that is, you know, every time we do turn the other cheek, every time we do forgive, every time we do refuse to give up hope, every time we do stand up for justice, every time we do share our belongings, every time we do initiate love, every time we practice vulnerable, sacrificial love, every time we let go of our lives and give it away, that is us following the messianic way of Jesus. That, if you like, is us partnering with divine action in the world. It's the power of God, but it's not the manipulative, forceful kind of power. It's love. And, you know, I think sometimes we can downplay what we do and how we do it. We downplay our lives and sort of see our lives as this kind of tiny drop in the ocean and a sort of speck of light in the darkness, but it really isn't that significant. But what if actually we're every time we make those choices, we're practicing something that resonates within the universe and reverberates across the universe, and it's the way of God, the way of Jesus, that is sort of cumulatively overcoming the powers of darkness, overcoming fear, overcoming power, violence, and control. And we're part of that. So we could see our lives perhaps a little differently. But let's think also about the uncomfortable nature of the conversation. You know, what learnings could we take away from this encounter that Peter and Jesus have? Well, I think based on what we've been talking about, let's remember, whoever we're in an uncomfortable conversation with, fear is always a factor. Right. Let's be aware of fear as a common denominator for the person we're talking to and for ourselves. Be aware of our own fears. You know what, and they could be all kinds of different things depending what the conversation is. But let's just be aware of that and ourselves choose the way of love, let go of fear, but also perhaps have more compassion on the other person because we realize, oh, they're afraid. They're afraid of what they're going to lose. They're afraid of whatever it is. Fear is always such a key factor because it's so deeply embedded in the human condition. So that's always going to be there. So let's be aware of that. Secondly, let's not try to defeat our enemies. The way of love is not about outdoing the other person. You know, so it's not about out-Romaning the Romans or out-Heroding the Herods. That if we're doing that, we're missing the whole point. And I think sometimes we can be in uncomfortable conversations and we come away from that conversation actually feeling good. We have a positive feeling rather than a negative feeling. But perhaps it's sometimes because we won, or I've got my point across really well then. Oh, that showed them, you know, I had the higher ground. We can get a bit self-righteous about it. Or we can be dominant and aggressive and sort of just defeat our enemies. Either way, let's not do it. In our uncomfortable conversations, let's keep love at the fore, because ultimately love is what's going to win the day. Love is what's going to prevail, not our rightness or correctness. Thirdly, let's not categorize people. Let's not categorize people as right or wrong. All people can be right some of the time and wrong some of the time. And I think we see that here with the way Jesus interacts with Peter. Jesus is not at all partisan. You'd think that Jesus would be like, well, Peter's got this revelation that I'm the Messiah. He's obviously enlightened. He must be, he's a good guy. So, you know, you would sort of trust his opinion, trust his perspective, once right, always right kind of thing. And I think we tend to do that with people, especially in politics, right? We take sides based on who we think's right, and they have to be right all the time, or most of the time. But here Jesus acknowledges that Peter was right. And then, you know, next moment, and we don't exactly know the chronology of the story, but certainly not too much later, having said, you know, you've had a revelation from the God of the universe, he's calling him Satan. And, Jesus is not holding back because, oh, well, he's one of my guys, you know, he's of the persuasion, the affiliation that I like. He's just being honest and truthful. So I think, you know, there's a lesson for us there in our uncomfortable conversations, not comparing our best with their worst, you know, the people we're talking to, not sort of making categories and being categorical and partisan. I think that can be such an unhealthy atmosphere in which to have an uncomfortable conversation. And then fourthly, let's not compromise our position to maintain support. And you know, I think we see this in both Peter and Jesus actually give us good examples of this. Jesus is way more intense probably, but Peter, you know, Jesus asks the disciples generically, who do people say that I am? And Peter, you know, we don't know who says what, but the group collectively, they say, well, you know, Jeremiah, Elijah, some say John the Baptist. But then when Jesus makes it very specific, he says, who do you say that I am? Peter speaks up and says, you're the Christ, the Son of the living God, the Messiah, the Son of the living God. And so Peter, you know, is, you know, maybe, who knows? Maybe that was just natural for Peter to say that. But it's also going out on a limb with your convictions. Sometimes we don't want to say what we really think, what we really believe, because we're afraid that it might alienate us, that people might invite more criticism or whatever. But Peter doesn't compromise his convictions here. And then certainly Jesus doesn't either. You know, Jesus could have thought in the second encounter, would be thinking, oh man, I wish Peter hadn't said that, but you know, he's one of my followers. I'm kind of feeling vulnerable because I'm just talking about the fact that I'm going to be, hunted down and executed. So I really need Peter on my side. I think we all feel like that at moments of vulnerability, and clearly Jesus feels vulnerable. And there was many times in Jesus's life where he feels vulnerable, and he wants to be with his friends, he wants to be with his followers. You know, there's something beautiful about the humanity of Jesus there. But we have, in this situation, Jesus uncompromisingly just saying what is real. And it's like, it's important because it literally is a matter of life and death. It's like the destiny of the universe hinges on this reality. Are you going to choose fear or are you going to choose love? And Jesus does not compromise. And there's something that's just unbelievably amazing about Jesus in my mind. You know, as I read these kinds of stories, I'm more in love with Jesus because Jesus, at that point where it really matters, he does not compromise. It's not like, oh, if, you know, once the going gets too tough, we'll resort back to compromise and perhaps, you know, entertaining a little bit of self-protection because of my fear and, you know, exercise a bit of power. Jesus just doesn't go there. It seems right there, having said, I want to build my church on this rock, on this, my following is going to be based on these messianic principles. It seems like, the temptation then is to sort of compromise that a little bit. He just doesn't do it. And he could lose that following. People might just turn around and say, well, forget it then. Peter doesn't at that point, but we know later on, obviously, Peter pretty much denies him and pretty much, you know, turns his back on Jesus. I mean, it all ends up well in the end, but you know, Jesus holds true, holds steady all the way through that. It's just amazing. It's really beautiful. So there's some learnings for us, some things we can take away and apply. I hope that's been helpful in some ways. We look at this really dramatic story. As I said, there's discussion questions this week, so do check those out. You can download them online. I'll help you dig a little deeper into some of all this. We're going to have communion now. And communion is this, we remember Jesus. We remember this meal that he had with his followers at a time when he was really, I think, feeling afraid. Jesus knows he's about to go, he's going to get arrested. It's inevitable. It's probably going to end in his death. And he just wants to spend this last time together, this last evening together with his followers. And he says to them, you know, I've earnestly desired to eat this meal with you. He wants to be in this place of friendship and love with those who are close to him. And so let's think about that as we take communion now. Just the vulnerability of Jesus and that vulnerable space that he invites us into, that again, if Jesus is the epitome of God, if Jesus is the fullness of God, Jesus says, if you see me, you've seen the Father. Paul says, Jesus is, or the Christ is the image of the invisible God, that when we're looking at Jesus, we're looking at God, and we're looking at vulnerability. We're looking at an invitation into friendship, an invitation into love. We're not looking at controlling power. We're not looking at violence. We're not looking at disdain. We're just looking at nothing but love. So as we come to communion, as we think about whatever has made us uncomfortable with the message today, or the sort of conversations we're having to have with people, or think we need to have have to have with people. Let's remember that we're coming into, or we are in communion with a vulnerable God. And I think that reality, that profound reality, changes everything. So I think that's why we do communion, right? Because we forget it so easily. We get off base. We lose our center. This is an opportunity for us to recenter ourselves. So as we take communion, let's just take a moment of silence to just reflect on this invitation into vulnerability and the unfathomable love of God that can change everything. So let's hold some silence and reflect on that, and then we'll take communion.